You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. My name is Tom Wright. I direct the Center for the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. And we're particularly delighted to welcome you all today to an important event on China's sanctions in Europe. And to begin with, I would like to throw it over to our president, John Allen, who made a pre-recorded message introducing today's event. So over to the video. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For those I've not had the honor of meeting, I'm John Allen. I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all to today's event, which focuses on the new and retaliatory sanctions China has imposed on the European Union and the United Kingdom. As many of you know, in March, the EU, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada applied coordinated sanctions against Chinese officials connected with severe human rights abuses against the Uyghur Muslims and other ethnic minorities in the Xinjiang province. Soon after, Beijing responded by sanctioning European think tanks, academics, EU committees, and European parliamentarians. Our panel today includes several individuals who were actually targeted by these sanctions. These retaliatory actions by China have been condemned by the European Union and the United Kingdom as an attack on democracy and are sure to complicate relations between China and Europe moving forward to include ratification of the EU-China Comprehensive Agreement on Investment, or the CAI. Furthermore, perhaps more importantly, recent events have also highlighted the importance of centering human rights in foreign policy, an idea we know is central to the Biden administration's aims for American leadership writ large. So with that important context, let me now offer a warm welcome to our distinguished panel for today's event, who will be introduced by my colleague, Tom Wright, who you've just heard from. It's truly an honor to host this prestigious group at Brookings, to engage with us on issues of democracy, human rights, and the future of the EU and UK relations with China. Again, welcome. Now, before I hand the floor over to Tom, a brief final reminder that we're very much on the record and we're streaming live. And Tom will begin by moderating the conversation with our panelists and then later taking questions from the audience. And on this latter point, should audience members wish to send us any questions, please do so. And do it by email to events@brookings.edu, that's events@brookings.edu, or by Twitter using #ChinaSanctions. That's #ChinaSanctions. So with that, it's a great pleasure to hand the floor back to Tom Wright, who will begin our event. Tom, the floor is yours.
Thank you, John. And I would invite the panelists to turn on their video at this point and audio, and I will introduce them. As John mentioned, this is an important event. On March 22nd, the Chinese government imposed sanctions on 10 European or EU parliamentarians and 4 EU entities. Several days later, they followed up with similar sanctions on the UK. Those sanctions were reportedly in response to European and American sanctions on individuals involved in the mass repression in Xinjiang province. I think it has been seen as a Rubicon of sorts. And we're particularly pleased today to be joined by 3 of those parliamentarians who are subject to those sanctions. Reinhard Bütikofer is an MEP for the Green Party, a former leader of that party, very active in the Foreign Affairs Committee in the European Parliament and very outspoken on these issues. Duvila Sakalin is a member of the CIMAS in Lithuania, a social democrat and very also outspoken on these issues. And Miriam Lexman is a MEP, a Slovakian MEP for the EPP, And also, obviously, I've spoken on these issues. And a little bit later, at 10 o'clock Washington time, we'll be joined by Laura Rosenberger, who is the Senior Director for China at the White House, who will also engage in this conversation. I'll talk with her, and then we'll have her talk with the rest of the panel, too. She would like to be here for the whole event, but we're very glad that she can join us for part of it. So before we jump into it, just one or two other housekeeping issues. Today's event is part of an ongoing partnership we have between Brookings and the Robert Bosch Stiftung, what we call the Brookings Bosch Transatlantic Initiative, or BBTI. This is a multi-year project that seeks to reinvigorate transatlantic collaboration on global challenges. And at the core of that effort is our drive to produce new ideas through increased dialogue and in-depth research to sustain and adapt the transatlantic relationship. We at Brookings place great value on Bosch's commitment to quality and independence, which I think is particularly important in light of today's discussion. And they've been an exceptional partner, respecting and recognizing the value of our independent scholarship. So we are grateful for that. And then, as John said, you can ask questions. Hashtag China Sanctions on Twitter, or email events at brookings.edu. And rather than group all the questions at the end, we will integrate those questions throughout the event. So I will ask the questions as they arise and as they fit in. So where I'd like to start really, and we'll get to the broader implications, I think, in a few minutes. But Miriam, maybe if I could start with you and then Reinhard and Duvilla. But what I'd really be interested in is just how this has affected you personally. How did you hear about this? You know, was it a surprise? Was it sort of expected? And what are just the implications for you as a parliamentarian in Europe? And then we'll come to maybe the broader implications in a minute. But Miriam, if we could start with you, and thank you again for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Thomas, and thank you for the invitation. It's a really great pleasure to be with you and have the opportunity to share primarily with the American audience. I mean, personally, I have to say that I had not expected anything like this. I'm only 1 year in politics. I joined the European Parliament in February last year. Previously, I was working for the International Republican Institute, and I would like to say that I would like to thanks to my previous employer, because the support from the US, but also from IRI, was very strong in my defense. And it was kind of interesting because I was in a touch with a journalist who is covering mainly Hong Kong, and we worked together on the issues related to Hong Kong and defend my efforts to defend democracy in Hong Kong. And in that morning, he wrote me if I expect to appear on the sanctions, because we knew that the Chinese probably will respond with the sanctions, with sanctioning some of the leaders. This happened already also in the States before, so we could have expected it. But I wrote him back that I don't think I'm such a big shark for China to be on the sanction list. And a few hours later, he was the first one who sent me the link to the Chinese Minister of Foreign Affairs issuing the sanctions. The sanctions are not really absolutely clear. I mean, obviously, it says that I cannot travel to China, and my family, neither my family, I cannot do any business or financial transactions. What is unsure is that it talks also about associated people to me, that the sanctions are also applied to them. And so far, I did not meet a lawyer who was able to explain me. I mean, we don't know exactly what it means. We don't know if we'll ever know what it means, because it might be also a phrase in such a vague way for purpose that practically also people who are working with us and associated with us will be not sure what they can or cannot do. What I also believe, what unfortunately can have an implication is that obviously I'm trying to be in touch with people who are coming from Hong Kong or mainland China. They mainly live already in the Western part of the world, in the EU or in the US. But obviously the contact with me, I don't know if this could be criminalized against them, and primarily against their family members or relatives who are still in China. So far, I don't know. I mean, personally, there is nothing, you know, that has changed my life from one day to another, because I wasn't planning to travel to China and I'm not doing business in China. But obviously the kind of day-to-day implications will be seen later.
Thank you. Thank you, Miriam. Reiner, you've been in the wars on this for a while. Did this come as a surprise to you? And can you talk us through a little bit just what happened on the day it was announced?
Well, thank you, first of all, Tom, and thanks to Brookings for putting this on. I think this is a great service that you're doing to transatlantic exchange on China. I was not completely surprised, I must say. The Global Times, which is kind of the central organ of the extreme nationalists in China, had targeted me before. And on the day when China announced their sanctions, there was an article that attacked me personally, together with Adrian Zenz, as two people that should probably get it. So I thought I might be on the honor roll, but I was surprised indeed to see the escalatory size of the overall reaction from China. Now, this is obviously not going to discourage me in my work. I don't think they expect that. It's rather injecting more vigor, but it does have personal consequences, of course. I will refrain from calling my Chinese friends in Hong Kong, because I would assume that their external contacts would be under surveillance, and I don't want them to be attacked for teaming up with somebody that China considers an enemy of everything Chinese, which I'm, of course, not. But I don't want to risk other people's future. So that is an impact that it will have. I will obviously not be able to travel to China, but other than that, I think and we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But I think the sanctions are more a signal of a political defeat than that China suffered than a signal of strength.
Thank you. Yuvila, you're not an MEP, but you are a member of the National Parliament. Can you talk us through a little bit your story and just why you think you were targeted and if it sort of came as a surprise and how it's affected you?
Well, it wasn't entirely a surprise. I am sitting on National Security and Defense Committee in Lithuanian Parliament for the second term. And since I was really honored to be invited to become a co-founder and co-chair of IPAC, and I think we've done quite, you know, nice job until now, and we are going to continue to do so. So I also see, as Reinhard, that this is a very typical totalitarian regime response when they are for 100 years now already used to intimidate people, and they probably forgot how in democratic countries people react. We are not intimidated. Actually, probably we get more motivated. And since I have been a human rights defender for 13 years before I entered the parliament, actually, I've been always dealing with a lot of inconvenient issues. I mean, be it Belarus or China or some decisions in Europe that are limiting rights of citizens. So I'm used to, you know, getting some hate waves or death threats or whatever. But when a huge, multi-billion country is trying to intimidate parliamentarians from Europe in somehow stopping us from defending values of democracy and fundamental rights, this is paradox. I think this is unprecedented. For the first time, sanctions are applied for defending human rights and not for human rights violations. But since I'm from a family of political prisoners and exiles that suffered from Soviet regime, from communist regime, we have not forgotten the communist methods. So I'm wearing this as a badge of honor and a lot of support from my colleagues, starting from Minister of Foreign Affairs, who called the ambassador immediately after those sanctions, or from Speaker of Parliament and all the speakers of European parliaments, as you know, stepped up for us. Or a very empathetic support from the president's office, president of Lithuania, that gives me, hope that standing united, and especially now standing united across the ocean, might actually get us in a better position than we've been for years before.
Thank you. Thank you all. So what I'd like to sort of move on to is, you know, why did they do this, I guess? I mean, you've all been pretty active on speaking out on European policy toward China in different ways and different aspects of that policy. And as we know, you know, in December, China made some last minute concessions on these investment negotiations that was seen as trying to pull the rug from underneath the Biden administration's efforts to have a multilateral approach to China. Then, you know, a few months later, they come in with these sanctions, which appear to erode support for their agenda and consolidate support for your position. So while it affects you personally very negatively and it's a bad thing, it could be seen as sort of strengthening, you know, the case you're making. And we have a number of questions already from the people watching. Helga Barth, at the Federal Foreign Office in Germany, asks, is imposing sanctions on Europe predominantly inspired by China's domestic policy? There's another question here from a student, Marcus Mashilvidis, asking if the targeting of MEPs means there'll be cross-partisan opposition to the vote on the investment agreement, and a number of other sort of questions in that vein. We can get on to the investment agreement in a minute. We don't need to talk about that now, but Reinhard, if I could start maybe with you on this, what do you think the objective and sort of rationale behind these sanctions was? And do you think they might work? I mean, do you think there's a chance that while people will stand by you all now, that it might have a chilling effect? Like, is there a strategic logic to what they've done? And is that concerning to you?
Well, I do think they followed a strategic logic, but because they misanalyzed the situation, they shot themselves in the foot. I believe that they misread in Beijing. They misread the message from the finalization of the comprehensive agreement on investment just before the end of last year. To put it bluntly, I think Chinese leaders figured that they had finally achieved one of their main goals of driving a wedge between the European Union and the U.S. Because obviously Berlin in particular, but also Paris and Brussels were more eager to send the signal to Washington that they insisted on their so-called strategic autonomy than to send a signal to Beijing that the transatlantic alliance was going to be back. So I think they underestimated the role of parliamentarians, the role of a democratic public in discussing the merits and the shortcomings of such a deal and the context, the geopolitical context. And they were taken aback that European foreign ministers felt obliged under pressure from the public conversation to put these sanctions in place. And in a way, it may have amounted to a huge loss of face for Xi Jinping himself, who had wrested the Europe file from Li Keqiang end of last year and was so overly proud of having pulled off this deal with Merkel. And now all of a sudden, not even 3 months later, the Europeans team up with the US and the UK and Canada to impose sanctions. I think that was what sort of made them very angry, and they didn't listen. I have indications that they didn't listen to their diplomats in Brussels that much. Probably their diplomats would have advised them not to go that far. But now that they have done it, I don't think they have a chance of really achieving their goals. Obviously, most governments have been very tough in showing their solidarity. The chancellor hasn't, but the foreign minister has in Germany. In other countries, The leaders of state and government have expressed their solidarity. Chinese ambassadors have been called in to be told off. So I think China has miscalculated, and this is not going to do them any good.
Thank you. And Miriam, how do you see this? And you know, what's your sense of where the debate is in Brussels and in the EU sort of as a whole and China? Has this shifted it dramatically? You know, we see the leaders, Reinhard referred to Chancellor Merkel, you know, didn't really talk about it yet. You know, are we in a little bit of a bump of sympathy, but that might, you know, evaporate over time? What's your sense of where we're at the moment?
Yeah, I completely agree with Reinhard. I think that the Chinese side has probably underestimated that the moods vis-a-vis China has been changing during the last year, and particularly also due to COVID and all the what was happening through the from the beginning of the COVID crisis, when we know that practically China is responsible. We don't know to what extent, but when Australia was asking for an investigation, there were China has completely kind of broken all the contracts and imposed tariffs, closed its market to Australian products. So China was bullying democratic part of the world. We know that China was trying and actually succeeded to change the report about Chinese influence on the public opinion in Europe, which was commissioned by the European Commission, that the wording of the influence of China was changed due to the pressure from China and due to the fact that some officials gave up to this pressure. We know that China was censoring the letter of EU ambassadors, which was published in China. So there are lots of indications we have seen throughout the year when China started to aggressively bully different countries and try to influence democratic institutions and the way how democratic institutions function in the EU. And I think people started to be alerted. Yes, China probably did its best to set up the stage when the investment agreement was finalized just before the end of the year. But that was not enough because the mood was changing beyond the stage. And I think now we see that, for example, the European Parliament, we have in few reports which we had issued on Hong Kong and the Uyghur minority, we clearly stated that the European Parliament is going to take human rights in consideration when scrutinizing the investment agreement. So there were already indications that people do understand that we cannot go with our China policy as it's set now, that we are vulnerable vis-a-vis China economically, but also in terms of security. And also, I mean, what I think that it becomes more and more evident that because there is so much, such a strong economic dependency in relation to the human rights issues, when products done by the modern slaves in China are ending up in our markets, we are becoming morally co-responsible for the human rights breaches. And I think this has woken up not only politicians, but many people in the EU member states. And I guess that now these sanctions are not helping China, are only opening even wider eyes to what China is able to do. And I think that we need to respond not only being alerted, but we really have to sit down as member states of the EU and change our strategy vis-a-vis China, change our policy vis-a-vis China, and also work even closer with our transatlantic allies, because I think this is very important as well, that we are as a democratic part of the world, we will jointly, also independently, but jointly seek how we are supposed to respond to the challenges China represents to all of us.
Thank you. Thank you, Miriam. Duvila, Lithuania, I think, was reconsidering or maybe even left the 17 plus one recently, the group of Eastern and Central European and Northern countries that engages with China. this has been in flux in this part of Europe for a few years. Can you talk us a little bit through maybe the impact that this particular incident has had on the general sort of debate on China in the national parliaments and in Lithuania, but maybe also just how you see this broader struggle over China policy, which it still seems to me, despite all of the different aspects of China's behavior over the last year or so with COVID and out of sanctions and wolf warrior diplomacy, it still seems to be a little bit on a knife edge, right? It's not a foregone conclusion that the point of view that you all represent will prevail or that Kai will be defeated in the parliament. So how do you see that debate sort of standing at the moment, both in Lithuania, but also more generally?
So definitely, I agree with Miriam that China somehow has definitely missed the changing winds of attitude towards China's expansive policy in all spheres. And of course, having in mind my background, I have been from my first time in parliament very wary of China's policies regarding human rights, economics, technologies, because what I see behind that is definitely not a goodwill intention, just, you know, to trade and etc. But also the COVID showed that, you know, the humanitarian diplomacy is also a very good a way to actually push your agenda, which is, in my opinion, in most ways incompatible with democracy and human rights values of European Union. But what I also wanted to note that, yes, actually, I'm glad that even being such a small country, Lithuania, in the context of 17 plus one format, has really made a really bold statement. We've been called by China Washington minions, if I'm correct. And I can also take that as a badge of honor, they want to call us that, because I feel that transatlantic relationship and our strategic partnership and alliance is very important if we really want to understand that, you know, blood T-shirts don't really bond well with the values of Western democracies. So they probably have missed that point, but having more and more data from more and more independent surveys, like, for example, one of them, just a year ago, showing that 570, almost over half a million Uyghurs that are working against their will in the cotton fields are delivering those cotton products to our market. And that does not sit well with us anymore. And this intimidation policy is actually helping us, me and my colleagues from Lithuanian parliament, from other national parliaments, to get our message across. This is a totalitarian regime that has not changed. We really have a very extensive experience with communist regime for more than half a hundred years. We know what they do. And even the lack sometimes of a very specific data because of you know, what they do to prevent experts to come and really collect all the data that would be really useful to understand how far the genocide has come forth. That helps us to understand that only us being all united in national parliaments with European Parliament across the Atlantic can really get the message through. Another important moment is when we're talking about technologies and security. I've been also pushing that issue for quite a long time, and I'm happy that my Committee on National Security and Defense also has taken very serious steps towards that, towards Huawei, and understanding that there is no independent businesses there in China currently. So we really have to understand the cost of that so-called beneficial economic cooperation. It's a mousetrap, not just a mousetrap that will hurt you. It's a mousetrap that would cut your head. So we really have to be aware about that also. So we are really in Lithuania now probably not only understanding how serious that is, but also planning quite a package of actions. Actually, in just 2 weeks in the parliament, we are having hearings about Uyghur issues, but also about other issues related to our guidelines of how we will deal with relations, contacts with China in the future. And that is, I think, for Lithuania, a very important step. Although when I proposed the resolution in the beginning of February, both committees, my committee, National Security and Defense, and Committee on Foreign Affairs, really friendly supported this. But colleagues in the parliament really were having questions about how we're going to proceed. So this unparalleled, unprecedented package of sanctions towards national parliaments and European parliamentarians sealed the deal.
Thank you. Fascinating. Thank you, Duvile. Reinhard, if I could come back to you. We've had a number of questions on the investment agreement, and Miriam, I'd love your thoughts on this as well. But where can you talk us through, Reinhard, just where this stands now and what its prospects are? And Natalie Liu, who's the diplomatic correspondent of the Voice of America, asks, you know, is there anything MEPs think the Biden administration can do or should do to stop or discourage the CI from being ratified? I guess a follow-up question might be, is it even necessary at this point? I mean, is it sort of finished, or, you know, what do you, or is there a prospect that it could be revived once things die down from this most recent incident?
Well, with regard to the comprehensive agreement on investment, I would not rely on President Biden and his team. They have enough on their plate. I think we're men and women enough to take our own good decisions there. The CAI had been in deep trouble way before the sanctions struck. And at the moment, I would say it's dead as a doornail. You just can't imagine that the European Parliament is being attacked as an institution and just proceeds with business as usual and goes to ratification of such a deal. And when I say we're attacked as an institution, I mean, this is not just sanctions hitting at individuals. They have targeted five individuals from the European Parliament, from all the four major democratic groups. They have targeted the China delegation, which should be their interlocutor, and they have also targeted the Human Rights Subcommittee. So we view that, and the president of the parliament said so, we view that as an institutional attack on our democratic institution. And even colleagues of whom I know that they are much more favorable to the deal than I have ever been have clearly expressed their frustration about China's actions and said, we see no way of dealing with that investment agreement as long as the sanctions are still in place. Now, I'm not saying this is not ever going to change, but the two most powerful proponents and motors behind the agreement, namely Mrs. Merkel and Mr. Macron, may not be in a position to push that much for that deal in the future. Merkel will be out of office before the end of the year, and Macron is finding himself embattled both from the left and the right in France over the deal. And he might not want to be making that legacy issue during his upcoming presidential election campaign. So I think it's a safe bet to say it is at the moment much less probable that this will be even up for ratification discussions over the first half of next year than people would have expected before the sanctions. And at the same time, we're pushing very hard in the European Parliament to emphasize autonomous measures like doing anti-subsidy measures or a ban, as Miriam said before, a ban on the importation of products of forced labor or human rights due diligence mechanism or enhancing the EU's investment screening mechanism. So there are tools with which we can promote our economic interests much more effectively than by pursuing CAI. And it's interesting to note that many voices from the business community are not more than lukewarm about CAI, because they see all the shortcomings of the deal in the first place.
Thank you. Thank you, Reinhard. Miriam, I'd love you to come in on this, but also if you could maybe address the a question of the role of business. I mean, you are, you know, in the EPP, the center right seems to have been a little bit more divided on China, interestingly enough, than maybe, you know, the center left or the Greens. I know there's a diversity of views in all political groupings, but of course in Germany, you know, it's the business. The business has changed on it, but still, you see aspects of business obviously supporting the investment agreement. So, could you just talk us a little through that? How do you see where this sort of stands in the parliament, and where do you think it's headed?
Yeah, thank you very much for this question. I will maybe continue when Reinhard has finished. It is important. I mean, of course, it's great that the US expresses and is helping us to maybe suggesting what solutions the US is taking in the different questions we have mentioned. The question is the human rights issue, where, of course, the US already implemented certain legal framework for due diligence. We are only in the preparation phase in Europe. So I think the cooperation should be on a different matters. That, for example, how to set the due diligence, that it's not causing more harm to our companies, which cannot be completely responsible for the human rights breaches in China. But of course, to the extent if they know about it and if they exploit the cheap labor of China, they should be made responsible. Also, the question is, in terms of due diligence, to what level of the chain we should go. I mean, we cannot make a shoe seller at the street, I don't know, somewhere in the middle of the US responsible if these shoes are made by forced labor in China, if the person doesn't know, because he buys it through different chains of companies. So it's very important to set this right, that it's not harmful, but it's really to the point, and it kind of addresses the problem we want to address. And since the US already is ahead of us, I think it's great to share expertise and experience. And this is the support we believe that should be strong among partners. The second question is, I would maybe mention, because yes, the kind deal is, it seems that it's supporting certain big businesses who are operating already in China and who needs more space and more, I would say, security and more equal treatment, which is legitimate. But we are more and more realizing that there is a vast amount of companies who are losing out because of the IP thefts, for example, and we are not giving the companies protection. And I think this is another area where we need to cooperate to look into the losses. And Dovila has already started this discussion, because she mentioned already that we practically count only that the Chinese market is going to help us economically. But we are not looking at the costs, which practically the illegal, cunning approach of Chinese companies often with state subsidies. So there is no really equal competition. Our companies are suffering. And I think that this is what we need to look into. And obviously, there are lots of companies which are operating both in the US and in EU. So we need to exchange data about the losses, because I think this is another argument that which needs to be put forward with lots of data and lots of information, that how much are actually the costs economically, I mean, calculated costs for how open we are to the Chinese companies and economic cooperation with China. Then the third topic and issue is security, because of course security costs too. And we need to know how much we are ready to pay for our security. And I think this is another calculation we need to make. And we need to also learn from each other and support each other with information where we actually have to invest and where we have to kind of bear the costs in order to provide security to our businesses, but also to people in general, also their data, that our populations are not manipulated through social media and through different tools from China. So these are the issues I think we need to open up. Not all of them are clearly related to CHI, but I think indirectly CHI is only part of it, and we need to look how we are supposed to, or how we can answer certain questions which were supposed to be answered through CHI, but we should answer them differently. And I think this is the debate we need to have in Europe, but also, I mean, I guess that the kind of expertise and cooperation here with the US is very needed and would be of profit for both of the partners.
Thank you. I have a question. It's sort of a statement as well from Stephen Erlanger of the New York Times. I'll just read it out. And David, I'd like to go to you next and feel free to comment on this, but I also have another question for you as well. And Stephen says, is it possible that China doesn't really care about whether the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment is ratified? It accomplished its goal, which is to send a signal to the Biden administration, and the agreement generally favors the EU, not China. So if it isn't ratified, why should Beijing care about it? So I think that I'll let you, Reinhard and Miriam, come back on that in a few minutes if you like. But Davila, if you'd like to comment on that, and then I would also like to pick up on something that Miriam said, another question that came in from Paul Nugent, the World Affairs Council in Southeast Connecticut. And he asks, you know, the U.S. is particularly active in pointing out human rights abuses by opponents in the West, but less so those of some in the West and its allies. Has this approach not undermined our attacks on China and Russia in the area of human rights? This is a big question, I think, that has come up many times, particularly after the January 6th insurrection here. How can we criticize China when we have our own problems in our own grouping? You've been very active on human rights for some time. Could you talk to us a little bit about how you sort of answer that question, and how you see whether it's linked, you know, our own record and maintaining a high standards of human rights within our own, you know, alliances, and that connection to being able to speak about it more generally vis-a-vis Russia and China, and how all of this is playing out, of course, in the propaganda war. I mean, the Global Times that Reinhard mentioned earlier, you know, they're always beating the drum on this. So how do you see that issue as well?
I remember that the former Commissioner on Human Rights from the Council of Europe has said that fundamental rights protection is not a Sunday dress that you wear on special occasion. It's a daily hard work. So despite whatever problems we are facing, and human rights problems, human rights and freedoms protection problems are a daily issue in every democratic country, because we acknowledge them, we recognize them, we try to solve them. There is always a lot to do. What we are trying to do is we try to identify, we try to find solutions, and we try to apply them as best as we can, and there always can be better solutions. When we are talking about totalitarian regimes, the main idea is to deny that they do have problems, or, you know, use that whataboutism idea. So what about you? What are you doing there? I also remember these anecdotal situations from my childhood when Soviet Union would say to United States that there is racism there. So how can you talk about human rights to us? So I told you my family history, and I'm glad that there were Western states and that the United States were supportive to Lithuania in so many issues. Because if we stand alone, we are much more likely to fail and to lose. If we stand united, we are much more likely to get tangible results. So when we are talking about what is happening in China, I really believe that what we need to do is to demand as soon as possible for independent international investigation into the ongoing Uyghur genocide. We can say alleged genocide, but we all have seen a lot of data. But at least according to two articles of Genocide Convention, genocide definition already shows horrible situation. We are not even talking about other systematic human rights violations, such as Falun Gong members, organ transplantation, and etc. But when we are talking about these horrible human rights violations, it doesn't mean that we deny our own. In Lithuania, I am dealing with that every day. Convention on Disability implementation, when we're talking about violence against women, gender-based violence, and etc. Of course, it's our daily work. It's how we look at it, how we deal with it. Do we really want to apply double standards, or do we apply the same standards so that no one anywhere should be trampled upon their dignity? No one anywhere should be made to work against their will in the cotton fields. No one anywhere should be sterilized because of their ethnicity. That's a very simple answer. And also then coming back to the trade agreement, I really feel that, yes, China felt quite arrogant about, you know, making that point to United States administration. And then I agree with Reinhardt, they shot themselves in both legs. I mean, first, you know, by sanctioning 10 EU individuals and entities, and then deciding, well, why not shoot our second leg and, you know, expand the sanctions to more European countries, to more people who are defending human rights, and to more parliamentarians. So in my opinion, either they are completely disregarding the differences between totalitarian regime and democratic countries and feel that we have become such a superpower that we can be completely arrogant and completely disregarders. But then United States and European market, we are quite a big player and we do have possibilities to make certain differences. And well, Reinhardt probably and Miriam in European Parliament can really make a better point than that than I do. But still, it's very easy to understand it. But also talking about the standards, what Miriam mentioned also is a very big headache for us. That's why we left in February and we made a very clear statement, but we don't really see the point in participating in the 17+1, which is actually made to divide Europe and not really bring an economic benefit. But also, say we sign, we ratify that agreement, feel that from our side, we're willing to keep to it. Is China really good to really adhering to international standards, to international conventions? Are they really going to hold up their side of the bargain? Now, I don't really think that we can have enough faith in that. So it's a very complex issue, really very complex.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that. Reinhard, you may want to comment on that, but I'd also like to bring in another question too, which is on Taiwan. You know, we have seen obviously a ratcheting up of tensions and provocations on the part of China on Taiwan recently. And we have a question from one of our audience members, which is, if China physically attacks Taiwan, will the EU be passive in its response or take material action against the Status Act? Obviously, there's a lot of there's a lot of space along that spectrum. It doesn't need to be a, you know, an all-out invasion. There can be different elements of coercion and pressure applied, which I think is what most, you know, experts believe China will do if it does escalate. Could you maybe talk to us a little bit about how the EU sort of thinks about Taiwan now? There's been maybe more links between the EU and Taiwan in the last 18 months. I was there last year. They sort of commented on the shift in attitude from the EU. But how do the parliamentarians and the broader European public and governments think about the issue of Taiwan?
Well, that's a very good question. Thank you for that. I would indeed confirm that the attention has been shifting. For a long while, Taiwan wasn't even on the radar screen of the European political arena. That has changed over the years, and we're now in the European Parliament, but also in the national context, paying more attention. For instance, in the electoral platform of my party for the federal elections in September, we're advocating explicitly the position that Europe should oppose any move by China to unite the country, unite the mainland and Taiwan by military force. This used to be a position that everybody in Europe would immediately take, but it's been waning over the years. And I think we have to get back to that very explicit position, and we're moving in that direction. I'm to say that explicitly, I'm not a supporter of Taiwan independence. I don't think that would help stabilizing the situation. I think we should take the attitude of supporting and defending the status quo. But in order to do that, we have to enhance our collaboration, our support for Taiwan's democracy, to do away with some of the restrictions that we've had around Europe for not meeting the leaders of Taiwan, for instance. Also, coming up with maybe a few new innovative ideas. In an op-ed that a couple of colleagues and I published last year, we proposed, for instance, to have a Taiwan-run Mandarin radio program in Europe. Maybe that could be a way of connecting more with Taiwan. So this is certainly going to play a bigger role. If you allow, Tom, I would like to make a remark answering to Stephen's question that China might be happy with seeing the CAI going down the drain because it's of no economic value for them. I'm not completely convinced that it would be of great economic value to them. In that much, I agree with Stephen. But for them, it mostly has been a political affair and not an economic affair. And as much as it was a great geopolitical gift from the European side to Xi Jinping under his Christmas tree to conclude that deal just 3 weeks before the Biden administration came into office, now that the Europeans are toughening their stance, this is also a setback for China. China meant to position itself as the central international player on plurilateral and multilateral trade relations. China signed the RCEP. China agreed the CAI. China wanted to pick up conversations with Korea and Japan. China indicated they wanted to join the CPTPP. So China meant to move into an arena that has been left by the United States. And not being able to pull off the European agreement in the end would be a political setback for that kind of an agenda. And therefore, I'm not sure that it would just not bother them at all. And the last point I would like to make with regard to the question from Paul. Obviously, when China hits back and points out mistakes that that we're making, we should listen. Just very simply, listen and look at the facts. If China criticizes anti-Asian racism wherever it happens, we shouldn't ignore that. We should work on that and counter that kind of racism. Otherwise, we would be guilty of double standards. But I would not agree with the statement that says you can only criticize a devil if you're an angel.
Nicely put. I might quote you on that and say when I'm asked about this again, that last line. Thank you, Reiner. Miriam, feel free to comment on any and all of just what went before. I'd like to, though, especially since, you know, Laura will be joining us in a few minutes, just ask also about the US-EU dimension to this and also the EU-Asian democracy dimension too, and the Quad. And, you know, what's happening in Europe, of course, is not unique to Europe. Happened in Australia, you know, particularly over the last 2 years, a lot of sort of economic and political coercion. There is a more of a collective response, not an alliance, but more of an international response. What do you think the main areas for international cooperation are between the EU and other democracies on China?
Yeah, I will maybe come back to some of the questions and then answer your question. In terms of, because I have been working in democracy support, as I said, I worked for the International Republican Institute before I became member of the European Parliament. And what I think was a great mistake of us democracies is that we believe that through economic cooperation, we are eventually changing the regimes we cooperate with into democracies. We believe that through this cooperation, the human rights situation is getting better while the economic situation is improving. I mean, from the perspective of the EU, I mean, there was a lesson which gave us this example from Central Eastern Europe, where I come from, Slovakia, where practically it was successful that the slow economic cooperation slowly helped Central Eastern Europe to get on track, you know, support the pro-democratic processes and become full-fledged democracies. I think years back, we had to learn and we were supposed to see that this strategy no longer works, that totalitarian regimes have learned how to use the economic cooperation into support of the regime, that the regimes practically were becoming richer, but the human rights situation often even worser because the regimes were stronger. And our great failure is in the fact that we have seen it, but we didn't want to see it. We knew that this is happening, but because we were kind of eager to cooperate further and further economically, because obviously it was bringing us gains too, we were unable to kind of reverse this process. And now we are realizing that this has turned back to us. And it's not only that we were indirectly supporting not democratic regimes, but these regimes learn how through this economic cooperation started to undermine our democracies, our institutions, democratic institutions, started to influence the public opinion and turning democracies into problems. And I think this is, has to be as a starting point when we think where we're supposed to go next. And what I believe, and I said it many times, that sometimes we kind of shy away from our values, that we believe that on a geopolitical level, we have to act differently, not to pursue the same values as back home. And I think this is a great mistake. I think democracies, our stronger point is actually our values, the values which brought, built the system of democracies in our countries. And we have to act through the same values and bring these values in our action geopolitically. And I would say maybe one example. I mean, if we are consistent on human rights, if we are consistent on free market competition, and we would protect this in our markets vis-a-vis Chinese companies, this will bring us gains, because now we are realizing that actually we are losing out through our economic cooperation with China. But we hope that one day it's going to change, but it's not really changing. It's changing to worse. And I think this is what we need to sit around the table as democracies and think, what is the strategic way how to pursue our values strongly and more consistently in our cooperation with different regimes? And I understand it's impossible to withdraw completely now, but we have to reset the way how we cooperate and be stronger in our positions. And in terms of Taiwan, we have to be step ahead, because I just want to say one thing. We knew what is going to happen in Hong Kong, and we are expressing our concerns again and again, and greater concerns and even greater concerns, but we are unable to stop the wheel because we are unable to make a clear step. And maybe, I mean, we as in the EU, we have not even imposed sanctions on the officials responsible for the human rights breaches and the deterioration of the situation in Hong Kong. And when it comes to Taiwan, we already know, and Reinhardt had said it very clearly, I mean, we have to now assume what can happen and make sure that we will be absolutely clear that this cannot happen, because there will be costs.
Thank you. Thank you, Miriam. Reinhardt, I know you have to go in a minute, and we'll be joined in a minute, I think, by Laura as well. But if I could just give you an opportunity to make any sort of final remarks in any of that, but particularly on the transatlantic dimension of this.
Well, thank you, Tom, and I apologize for having to leave, but I would want to highlight just one idea, one issue, which is, and we haven't spoken about that yet, but several very prestigious research institutions and researchers have also been hit by the sanctions. Merix, the largest European China think tank, Björn Jerden from Sweden, who is going to head Sweden's China Competency Center, and Adrian Zenz, whom I mentioned already. And I think it is important, and I'm grateful to all the academics and to all the people from the think tank world who have spoken up to defend these colleagues. But I think it is very important also to emphasize this dimension and not just look at the politicians. Because what China is trying to do, and Global Times has expressed that in writing, it's trying to limit our ability to analyze what happens in China, to limit our understanding of what's going on in China, as if they wanted to say, look, the barbarians are not don't need to understand what we do. We'll tell them what their role should be. This imperial arrogance from China has to be pushed back against. And I think one elementary ingredient is indeed solidarity among people in the academic and think tank communities. Thanks for being part of this and allowing me to also participate here.
Thanks, Reinhard. And that's an excellent point. And I would say we did ask the head of Merix to join us, but he had a conflicting engagement today. But you're exactly right. And I think we also want to send this message clearly, of course, that we will engage with those institutions and stand with them as they are sanctioned by China. I would also just add on a personal note, the last time I was in China, I think was about 3 years ago, and it was with on a small group delegation with Michael Kovrig. Subsequently was arrested when he went back several months later. And I think we of course also at this event should note that Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor are still detained without, you know, due process in China, and they should be released. But thank you, Reinhard, and feel free to stay on for as long as you want, or drop off whenever you need to. Davila, as we sort of, Laura will join in a minute, but just could you maybe just talk to us a little bit about the transatlantic dimension and how you, and also the Asian democracy piece of this, and how important it is for you to see real international cooperation on how to respond to actions by China.
Actually, if I could go back very shortly, when we were talking about personal repercussions that we felt after those sanctions, actually what they apply to us, trying to intimidate us, the parliamentarians and also the academics, is also applied directly to our family members. So, for example, my husband is a diplomat for 2 decades. He can never enter China. He cannot work with China. And what happens is that this is, I think, very illustrative, that what they apply is this tactics of, you know, trying to punish, intimidate, and apply that, you know, to people who are not even, not only innocent, but they are not even participating in the issues that are being punished for. So in my opinion, when we are talking about the transatlantic context, what is very important for us to understand that we are in the same team, that this really small European country, Lithuania and United States, we are playing in the same team. We are playing for democracy. And that's why for me, my country's position that we are ceasing participation in 17+1, which I completely agree with our Minister of Foreign Affairs when he said this is made to divide Europe. This is a very good step into the direction of us being as unified as we can. next to that, European Union and United States of America is also, in my opinion, in a dire need to make as strong bridge as we can to really resolve any questions that we can, so that we could actually make a very united position towards issues that are important to both our countries. So I'm not a foreign policy analyst. I've been working with human rights and certain security issues for many years. So in my opinion, limited opinion on the issues that you've asked, I'd say that the strongest weapon, I don't want to use that word, weapon seems very, you know, undiplomatic, but tool, okay. So the strongest tool that we have is our ability to resolve our issues, our ability to discuss, our ability to exchange the analytical information, our ability to work on both democratic and security issues together, our ability to actually analyze the threats behind those so-called economic benefits, our ability to see through the double agenda that is being thrown over to us. And as I see that our next panelist has joined us, then I will add no more to this, and I'm hoping that we can continue later.
Thank you, Davila. And yes, we're delighted to be joined by Laura Rosenberger. Laura, thank you for joining us. I know, you know, you're super busy, and we really appreciate the time. And I think Laura is known to most people who will be watching this, who are engaged in these issues. Laura served in many positions in previous administrations in the State Department, originally, and is back now being a China expert, but for the last 4 years ran the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund and did an enormous amount of work with European allies and partners, not just on the China dimension to the challenge to democracy, but also, of course, Russia and broader challenges, particularly in the technological space, and now as a senior director for China on the National Security Council. And I think it's a sign of how important this issue is, you know, here that Laura is with us today. So, Laura, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks, Tom, for the invitation. And it's so great to see other friends on the screen and be able to join you all. And sorry for weird technical glitches here. It's a little bit of a challenge sometimes in our space over here. So we're trying to, I hope that we got rid of the big backlighting there. So anyways, but Tom, thank you so much for hosting this. It's such a really, really important conversation. And sorry that I'm joining you partway through, but really delighted to be with all of you today.
No, thank you so much. And I'll just bring you up to speed a little bit, Laura, on what we talked about, and then we'd love to, you know, chat for 10 or 15 minutes, and then we'll bring Davila and Miriam back in. Reiner just had to drop off another engagement, but passes on his best regards and appreciation for you joining this. So we started out by talking to our three guests really about how this has affected them personally, because, of course, in addition to it being a geopolitical issue, it's also a personal issue. It has implications. I think some of them were surprised, some of them are not. Maybe Reinhardt was expecting it, being regularly attacked in the Global Times. But Miriam maybe came a little bit more out of the blue. But I think they've all been encouraged by the support internationally, but from in Europe, and feel that the tide has turned a little bit on some of these discussions. And we also talked about the implications for talking about human rights in foreign policy and how it's important to do so, even when we deal with our own challenges. And Davila spoke very eloquently about that. And we also talked about the transatlantic dimension and, you know, Taiwan and other pieces of this too. So I guess, Laura, my initial question to you is just, you know, how does the White House think about the importance of, you know, what has happened with these sanctions on European parliamentarians and think tanks and UK parliamentarians and think tanks and entities as well? And is it sort of a crossing of the Rubicon moment? How does it fit into the broader picture of what you're looking at geopolitically?
Well, thanks, Tom. And again, thank you for having this conversation, because it is so critical. So let me actually start where you ended there, with sort of how this fits in that broader picture, and then zoom in specifically to how we're thinking about Beijing's imposition of these sanctions in retaliation for our collective actions. You know, the Biden administration has been clear that working with our allies and partners is a really central piece to our approach to China. We believe that there is so much more that we can do together when we are working to address the challenges that we face globally in terms of upholding the principles of the international order, upholding the universal values that we all hold dear. I think panelists and your audience will have likely seen President Biden's very clear comments on the importance of values in our foreign policy and specifically in our approach to China. And I think that that is an area where we are seeing a lot of commonality, in particular with our European allies and partners, and where we see a lot of space for additional cooperation, as well as other areas that are in our deep interest. We've done a lot of work over the past couple of months since we came into office to really rebuild and restore some of the foundations of our alliances and partnerships, both in Europe and in the Indo-Pacific. And of course, Secretary Blinken's early trip to Europe a few weeks ago was an opportunity to really begin to fortify some of that work. And of course, he was in Europe just as all of these retaliatory sanctions were hitting. So I see our transatlantic cooperation on China as absolutely essential to dealing with the challenge that we face from China, but also in both upping our own competitive game. I think we often think about sort of the work with, or at least I think the framing of work together with allies and partners is sometimes framed just in terms of countering something else. And I think it's really important that we also understand that we're for something. And our collective actions on these sanctions was actually an example of that, where we are for the values of upholding human rights globally. And are going to speak out together on those. So I think, it's within that context that we see both the collective action that we took, the EU, US, Canada, and the UK. And I know Norway also recently aligned itself with the EU sanctions as well. I think this collective statement is a really, really important moment of demonstrating that these concerns about China's human rights abuses are not held by any one country, but are really shared amongst like-minded democracies. And it's really about those violations of universal values. And Beijing's retaliatory actions, of course, are also of deep concern to us. The way in which it impinges on academic freedoms, the way in which it is trying to engage in coercive economic activities, which we see in a number of places around the world. And so we stand in solidarity, of course, with our friends on screen here and others who have been targeted by these coercive and retaliatory actions.
Thank you, Laura. And Laura, we have a number of audience questions that have come in throughout the morning. We've been just integrating them into the conversation, and one and some from journalists as well. One from Dmitry Sevastopolov of the Financial Times asks, what other steps will the Biden administration take with allies in Xinjiang? And are allies more or less willing to stand up to China after these most recent sanctions? And I guess that gets to the broader question of, how has the mood sort of changed over the last couple of weeks? And how do you think that sort of fits into to the agenda going forward?
Thanks, Tom, and thanks, Dmitry. I'm not going to speak for our allies and partners about where they're at and in their own thinking. If Miriam and Davila want to speak to some of that from their own perspectives, happy to do that. I guess from where we're at, though, what I would say is, look, we see growing concern in many capitals about both China's actions in Xinjiang, as well as, again, these this sort of coercive and retaliatory actions that we've seen. Of course, it extends to some of the targeting of companies through boycott movements as well within within China for companies that are saying they're not going to use products that, you know, are a result of forced labor. And so, you know, as we are across a range of different issues relating to China, we are engaging in very regular conversations with our allies and partners about what more we may be able to do. I'm not going to preview any specific steps right now, but certainly I would say those are ongoing conversations. I think that we see mounting concern about what, you know, about the ways in which China is flouting international rules and norms and values. And it's an area where we see opportunities to continue to build. But we believe these are conversations we need to have together with our allies and partners to understand where each capital is at and you know, be able to build as we go along.
Thank you. I'll bring back in Duvila and Miriam in a minute, but just one last question, which is, you know, you've worked on Europe and on Asia. You're back on the Asia file now. You know, democracies, you know, spread across, you know, North America, Asia, Europe have pretty similar interests and values. There are some differences too, of course, but could you talk to us a little bit about, you know, how, you know, the Quad piece of this, you know, and the Europe piece of this, and how it all sort of fits together, and if you think there's sort of a good prospect of more trilateral or, you know, sort of democratic cooperation, which I know is a big theme of the administration, but how does that sort of unfold in practice from where you sit, and given your sort of most recent experience sort of working on these issues of maybe a little bit more of a transatlantic angle?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we see you know, our allies and partners in both Europe and in the Indo-Pacific is absolutely central to what we're trying to accomplish. And the more connectivity that we can build between our European allies and our Indo-Pacific allies and partners, I think the better off we're going to be. I think that we see a lot of discussions in European capitals and in Brussels about the ways in which Europe can be doing more in the Indo-Pacific region. I think we see the Quad as a springboard for being able to build out additional pieces. But I think in general, we're looking to see, you know, as we're early days here, even though it feels less than early in the sense that we've been off to a sprint, I think, over here, moving out early on a lot of fronts. But we're really looking to identify with each of our allies and partners, what are their interests? What are the different pieces that they want to work with us on? Where do we have vulnerabilities that we can work together to address collectively or with one another? And I think that we're interested in a number of different ways that we can partner in kind of flexible arrangements that will allow us to leverage one another's strengths as best we possibly can and to stand with one another. And so we really welcome, you know, further engagement between Europe and the Indo-Pacific. There's a number of different efforts that we see underway that are building those out. I'm glad to hear you talked about Taiwan earlier as well. I think, you know, the United States, obviously consistent with its one China policy, has our own you know, unofficial relations with Taiwan. We think it's really important that, especially with our democratic allies, we can work to expand Taiwan's international space for its appropriate participation in, you know, in international institutions and to engage on areas where there is a lot of work that we can do together. Of course, Taiwan, much like many of our European partners and allies, has experience with things like, you know, with threats to democracy, with disinformation, with other kinds of hybrid threats. And I think there's a lot of work that can be done there to learn particular lessons on those issues. So we're seeing all of these different configurations as platforms to build from, but very interested in building that broader connectivity.
Thank you, Laura. So I'd like to bring back in Duvila and Miriam. And Miriam, maybe if we could start with you, but just to offer you a, a chance to comment on anything Laura said, but also on maybe what your priority would be if the US and the EU were to work more closely together on China. What do you hope will be accomplished later this year?
Thank you very much. Hello, Laura. We know each other from the pro-democracy and kind of supportive to democracy's world. Yes, I think I mentioned it already briefly before that what I believe where it's absolutely necessary to work is to exchange among officials and civil servants that we know each other's steps, we can learn it from each other's mistakes or also successes. When we are proposing legislation, for example, I mentioned the due diligence, which the US is already ahead of us. So obviously, I think what will help is really kind of a practical exchange where you see problems, where the legislation is functioning, what needs to be maybe changed, so we can kind of learn the lessons from each other. In terms of also the intellectual property thefts, I believe that this is an area where we really need to coordinate and see how we can legally protect our companies, because I'm kind of learning the depth of this problem only now, I mean recently, that how much our companies are losing out, and there is no even a legal framework which is protecting their interests, which are also our interests. And I think this is an area where we definitely need to work more closely together. Another area is the direct foreign investment screening, to see how to do it efficiently. In terms of critical infrastructure, obviously the 5G is one of the most debated areas where I think we need to see how we can cooperate here. I mean, there is this transatlantic alliance where the US with a couple of EU member states have practically agreed that they are not going to use Huawei, but we need to find a solution how this network is going to be built up. Germany is investing into research. I think there is a way how to coordinate in terms of business and research that this is being done within the transatlantic community or democratic states. Here I would also mention, when I'm talking about research, where this was not mentioned in our debate yet, and I have tried to kind of open this issue in many debates, is the academic area and research. We need to protect our research more thoroughly, because I think there is a lot of loss of intellectual property already being done through our universities, through our research centers. And I think that there is not enough of, or we do not pay enough of attention to this. But also, I think what we need to look into is not only the protection of our markets from the work, from the products which are being done by the modern slaves in China, but what I think we need to also make sure that our technologies are not being used, for example, in order to impose surveillance on people in China, because this is unfortunately happening, that it's not only that we need to protect our markets, but we also have to make sure that our products are not being used for human rights violations in China, but also elsewhere in the world. So I think these are the areas where we need to really coordinate. And I think there is one more area. I think we have to deviate our economic interest. Yes?
Could I let you come back in 1 second? Because I just realized Davila has to drop off a few minutes early. So I just wanted to give you a quick chance and we'll come back to you in a second. Sorry, Davila, I should have come to you first, but I just recall.
Thank you. Actually, it's such an engaging conversation that I just realized that also about 20 seconds ago. Actually, I agree with all that Miriam said, and I would add to that, well, definitely we have certain areas that probably we could have covered better, and we could have worked together better. But what is important is that our strategic partnership and alliance is, in my opinion, growing stronger than ever. So that is a very big hope for the future. And what we couldn't do for Hong Kong, I'm hoping that we would definitely take steps that this would not happen to Taiwan. because seeing the growing levels of aggression, of imperialism, of that arrogant attitude, I am worried. I'm very openly worried, and I think that we have a lot to talk about and a lot to do together. And I understand that I'm from a very small country, but, you know, we're still proud that being a very small country, we broke down the Soviet Union, and China definitely remembers that. What we see from Intel data and from the open sources, we do remember that. So I think that, you know, every member of, on the team counts. And adding to what Miriam said, definitely, I'm happy that when we're talking about, for example, investment screening, we in Lithuania on national level have built quite a strong infrastructure, and we even strengthening that because we, well, we haven't forgotten what has been happening with totalitarian regimes on our skin for so many years. But next to that, I believe that we could do a lot together strategically, Europe and United States, when we're talking about hybrid threats and especially informational warfares, because, well, we've seen where that leads us. And next to that, cybersecurity, because that's definitely an area that is not covered enough currently, but we do have a lot there, and somehow to balance protection of human rights, but also protecting national security interests, or even I would say Western security interests, because that's very important and the geopolitical field might be shifting. But certain alliances and strategic partnerships, I am sure, will sustain anything that is thrown at us. So I was absolutely delighted to participate here today. And thank you, everyone, you know, for sharing such valuable insights. I really do have a lot to think about it after this conversation. But then I'll have to talk now about Uyghurs with Turkish television, so I'm hoping that they also remember something. Maybe I'll try to remember. So thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you. We appreciate you joining us. And Miriam, sorry to have to interject. No worries. Why don't you, maybe if you finish that thought, and then Laura, we can come back to you for a final closing comment.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, I just wanted to say final two things. One thing is that we need to, I think, deviate our business interests and cooperation from China to within the democratic part of the world. So we need to support stronger economic cooperation among democratic countries, because then we have at least certain guarantees that the economic profit is not either supporting human rights deterioration or it's not undermining our democracies. And the final thing is that we need to be more strategic, not only to look as a kind of Western democracies vis-a-vis China, but we need to look at third countries which are exploited by China and prepare a strategy there, because if there is no strategy, this is going to turn against us too. I mean, we know that China is expanding its interest in Africa, the Balkans, the Eastern Partnership countries, all around the world, Latin America. And if we will not have our foot in the door, then this might turn against us, because if China is going to buy the infrastructure, especially strategic infrastructure in these countries, it will be having enormous negative impact at the global setting and in general, and we won't be able to reverse it. So I think this is something which is urgently needs to be addressed by democracies.
Thank you. Laura, do you want to comment on any of that and just maybe a closing remark?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as always, I learned so much from my friend Miriam. It's so good to see her. And it was so good to hear from Davila as well. So I think that these kinds of practical areas that Miriam and Davila have just listed out are absolutely the pieces that we need to be drilling down on with one another across the Atlantic. There are so many areas, whether it's investment screening, the IP theft question, how to protect our research base while being consistent with our values. You know, these are all really, really critical areas. I want to pick up, though, on one specific piece that Miriam just pointed to there, which is cooperation in third countries, because I think this speaks to what I was mentioning earlier, the fact that we need to be developing together affirmative plans that are consistent with and uphold the international rules-based order, and that provide provide the ability for countries to be resilient to the kinds of coercive activities that we often see from Beijing in them. And so I think this is an area where we very much welcome additional cooperation and dialogue across the Atlantic. And I think there's a lot more for us to do there. You know, when Secretary Blinken was in Brussels a couple weeks ago, he announced the relaunch of the US-EU dialogue on China. And I think that will be a really important mechanism for us to be able to really drill down on a number of these specific pieces. And I think it's a welcome opportunity for us to do that. I think we see it as a really important piece of business. And, you know, I would just say again, I think we are, you know, very we have taken some really important steps early on here in the Biden administration. But we have a lot of work to continue to do to build on that. And so we just really look forward to standing with and working with our European allies as we work on building out our approach to dealing with the challenge from China.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Miriam. Thank you also to Reinhard and Davila for joining us earlier. And thank you to my colleague Inesia for putting all of this together. We really appreciate it. And we look forward to remaining engaged, obviously, on all of these issues and also at a future point, hopefully, to doing something with some of the European think tanks who are also subject to these sanctions. But thank you all for joining us. Thank you also to the Robert Bosch Stiftung for their partnership on this event. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.